It's Lucky's really long list of movies.
Woo! It's the very first episode.
Hello. Hi, my name is Lucky Damn Day. That's right. And this is my podcast where I tackle my really long list of movies that I have never seen before. I'm not a movie buff. Quite the opposite, actually. I'm a movie dum-dum. I haven't seen much, but that all changes starting today. I really do love movies, though, but I've never allowed the time to actually just sit down and tackle this list of movies. And I don't want to just watch the movie. No, I want to know all about it. Who made this? How? Why? When? I have questions and I'm finally seeking answers. But this list is monstrous, so I'm going to be splitting it up into categories. So each month, I will be making up a category, and I will be pulling movies from my list that fit this category, and I guess my life will change forever. So this month's category is movies that make people scream at me because I haven't seen them.
What? You mean you haven't seen The Godfather? You haven't seen Pulp Fiction? The Matrix? You haven't seen any of these movies?
And then their head explodes, and gray matter is so hard to get out of a fresh Burmese lotus flower silk top, I tell you. But no, I haven't seen those movies. I haven't seen The Titanic. I haven't seen The Notebook. And the list goes on and on and on and on. Literally. And I'll be tackling it for you today. So without further ado, whatever the hell that means, on with the show. This was one hell of a first episode. Yeah, the movie was pretty good. But the weird little journey for me to admit that was a little surprising. God, and I'm so embarrassed by my first take. I'll share that with you later on. So for starters, I would frequently find myself in conversations at bars, parties, shows, backstage at shows, weddings, whatever, and Pulp Fiction would come up. And I would try my best to stay silent so I could hide my atrocious secret that I had never seen Pulp Fiction before. Eventually, my secret would come out. Someone would try to lay down reference after reference from Pulp Fiction, and once the references didn't relate to the girl with the black bob on the movie poster, the twist, or the needle to the heart, I would have to confess. And after getting this confession beaten out of me, I was not met with sympathy nor understanding. I would be yelled at, accosted, reduced to uncultured swine. Of course, I would plead my case. I haven't gotten around to it. I do want to see it, but it's not streaming. I was only 23 months old when it came out. I begged my parents to take me to the theaters. I cooed, I gawed, I booed, I hooed. And my pleas fell on deaf, neglectful ears. After the first or second decade of being yelled at by mostly strangers, the desperate explanations started to evolve into defense mechanisms, fueled by rage.
I don't want to see it. I don't know what the big deal is. I feel like everyone talks about it so damn much. I feel like I have seen it already.
I'll admit it, I started to develop a hatred for Pulp Fiction and Quentin Tarantino. Why does my value as a human, a neighbor, a potential friend, plummet after admitting that I didn't see this movie? Now I don't want to fucking see it. Are you happy now? Are you?
Now I don't want to fucking see your fun fucking little fucking flick. Fuck this movie and its creator.
And then I watched the movie for the first time 1 week ago. And I was angry for some reason. I enjoyed the movie. I laughed. I gasped. I liked how pretty it was. But for some reason, when it came to researching and going further into the Tarantino-verse, I was annoyed. Was it because everyone kept calling Quentin Tarantino a genius and didn't really explain why, and I also just couldn't see it? Was it because Uma was only in the first half of the movie? Was it because Quentin cameoed and said the N-word 4 times in Samuel L. Jackson's face? The pawn shop scene? I thought so. I thought those were the reasons. But when I was watching the movie, again, for the 4th or 5th time within this 1 week period, I realized I was never watching the movie. I wasn't allowing myself to watch a movie. I think I was too busy looking for reasons to prove that my hatred for this movie was justified. I even shifted my hatred from the movie to Quentin Tarantino. It's his fault that I'm getting yelled at. So yeah, fuck you, man. But then I was looking more into Quentin Tarantino. I thought I would find more controversy. At first, I was like, he's a hack with a beautiful eye for aesthetics. All he does is steal, 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 and reuse. But then I learned about his writing. Actually pretty impressive. And he doesn't hide the fact that he does steal and intentionally use from other filmmakers from the past. And it kind of does help. And it kind of helps. It kind of does help. With the storytelling. God, why is this still so painful to admit? And then I found out about the Uma Thurman crash from Kill Bill, and I was like, "Naha! Now I got you, motherfucker!" But then I saw he said that that was like heartbreaking. It was a heartbreaking event and one of the worst mistakes of his career, if not his life. But I don't know if he said that before or after he assisted in keeping the footage of the wreck out of her possession for almost 15 years after she requested it. She was permanently injured after that, y'all. And it just called for more research that did not pertain to this movie, and I don't have that much time. But still, it left me confused. So hating the movie didn't stick because I liked a lot of it. And hating Quentin didn't stick because he's a bit more honest than I thought. He's still a bit controversial, though. And I could only focus on the interviews from the Pulp Fiction release period because all of his interviews that happened after Pulp Fiction but still pertained to Pulp Fiction got really confusing because, you know, it was his second movie out of an entire, like, universe that he's created. So they just keep referencing all these movies I haven't seen in these interviews. And I do not have time this week to look at the entire fucking Tarantino-verse. And I thought Quentin Tarantino was a bit cocky in these newer interviews. And that's just an opinion that apparently can change. That all being said, I have reluctantly come to the conclusion that this is a very good movie. I still have a few reservations. And that Quentin Tarantino is an exciting director and writer. A strange actor. I still have to be warmed up on that one. But I don't trust him 100%. So how do I go from hating Quentin Tarantino to actually liking one of his blockbuster cult-inducing movies? Well, I made an episode about it. And also all the movie magic stuff, cool behind-the-scenes stuff, and Easter egg stuff. This was just an experience. So let's just get on with it, huh? All right, so this is probably the most embarrassing part of this episode. I'm going to be sharing with you for some fucking reason. I told myself that I needed to do this. I'm going to be sharing my first take with you. So I typed out my first take, and I'm going to read it to you. And I'm probably going to cringe a lot while reading this because of just how fucking angry I was. And please remember that I had been yelled at and belittled by condescending, pretentious pricks for decades about this movie. I was annoyed before I even hit play. Still had a good time, though. Okay, these are my thoughts after I watched the movie for the first and only time in my life. Literally just seeing it once, I wrote myself an email that I'll read to you now. I'm going to cringe, so feel free to join in. All right. So, I have realized that I can react in the moment when watching a movie, but it takes some marination and maybe a few more watches before I can lay down how I feel about it. And I think that's okay to say. Pulp Fiction is one of the movies where a lot went down. We had fun, we laughed, we did drugs, crashed cars, we resurrected, we got money, ate kahuna burgers, sipped on $5 milkshakes, and saw Quentin Tarantino say or shout the N-word over and over and over and over again. And I think... I don't agree with this one, but okay. I think the writing for women in this movie was on the weaker side, except for Uma in the jackrabbit scene. I felt her character was very interesting, but as soon as she came, she left, and we never saw or heard of her again. I don't think the writing is on the weaker side. But I do definitely still agree with this part, though. Also, Mia Wallace really reminded me of Dakota Fanning's character from Uptown Girls. Ray, I don't know. Maybe it's the bob, bangs, and all-knowing scowl. What if Ray grew up to be Mia? But I do wish Mia was a bigger part of the movie like I thought she was. I didn't think this movie was a masterpiece. There were a lot of great moments and good work. And then there was some weak, sloppy, pointless, shocking moments that struggled to mesh with the great moments. Watching Samuel L. Jackson act afraid of Quentin Tarantino was really weird and took me out of the movie for a second. I thought Quentin's acting was ass. An ass I wouldn't even trust with a golden watch. It's so weird to see him act so terribly, but then he is able to direct some of the best talent in the century. So I guess he can't really give the best acting notes. He can put together a pretty shot and knows how to use music in a movie. Wow. I hated him, huh? For the most part, I really locked into this movie, and then it felt a little out of control during some parts. Like a different brain had written the parts of the movie that I liked. And the shock stuff, as always, annoying and unneeded and a cheap way to get a reaction. And the music was really fucking good. The sets were great and dingy and colorful, and the camera tricks were fun. It's a good-looking movie. And that was my first take of Pulp Fiction.
Woo!
I am sweating. I'm sweating because I'm scared. I'm scared to put this in the podcast. I'm scared to put it in the podcast because of how hateful I was and how, like, enraged I was and how, like, stubborn I was and how I was like, this is definitely how I feel and I'm gonna feel this way until I fucking die. I knew it. This movie was blah, 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 blah. Quentin Tarantino's just blah, 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 blah. Like, when really... it's a good movie, and Quentin Tarantino, I think, did a good job on this movie, and I did not look into him after this movie. So there's probably a whole nother part of Quentin Tarantino that I don't know about that could be really bad, or it could be really good, or it could be really neutral. I'm just putting that in there, because again, I don't trust men in Hollywood. So, thank you for letting me share that with you. I'm sweating. I'm making up my decision right here, right now. I am going to put this in the podcast because I don't think I'm the only person that has this same reaction to Quentin Tarantino stuff, especially if you have not been watching Quentin Tarantino stuff. For me, also, this might just be for just me, but I was like really intimidated by the Quentin Tarantino fan base. I don't know what they call themselves. Let me look it up. What do you... call a Quentin Tarantino fan. Tarantino fanatics. Cinephile? Okay, I can't find it right now. I don't know. Also, if you are a Quentin Tarantino fan, what is the fan base called? Oh my God. If I was Quentin Tarantino, I would just call my fan base the Cuties. QT? Are you guys the Cuties? Are y'all Cuties? Aww, okay. I'm gonna call you Cuties. All right, so that was a little bit about me and about the headspace I was in after I watched this movie for the first time. Wow. But don't worry. Sorry, is that my cat? Don't worry. I get over it and I get into it. So, okay. He is so bossy. He's like, move on. You're losing him. You okay, boss man? We're moving forward. Okay, so let's start talking about the movie. I just want to break down the main characters. To start off this incredibly talented roster, we have Marcellus Wallace, the big boss, played by the powerful and smooth Ving Rhames. Bruce Willis plays the deadly militant boxer, Butch Coolidge. Oh my God, and Samuel L. Jackson in this movie? God, he did such a good job. His performance in this movie was caviar. So rich and delicious. I'll gush later. But yes, Samuel L. Jackson played one of Marcellus's hitmen, Jules Winnefeld. John Travolta was the iconic and idiotic hitman, Vince Vega. Such a cool name. And of course, the enigma herself, Uma Thurman, who is Mia Wallace and rocks the most recognizable black bob that complements her bloody nose. The entire cast was star-studded. Tim Roth as Pumpkin, Christopher Walken, Harvey Keitel, Amanda Plummer, Phil Lamar. I love you, Phil. And I was so excited to see you in the opening credits, but then, you know, oopsie poopsie kablam. But basically, this is a gangster movie about a few different storylines that continually overlap. The story is also shown out of order on purpose. People get shot, there's drugs and crime, and a kick-ass soundtrack. I'm going to pick apart some of the scenes and share my thoughts, and more importantly, fun facts, and some of the movie magic stuff. And I'm gonna go in chronological order. Okay, smarty pants. What comes first in the story? Like, chronologically, not what was shown on film, in the theater, on streaming, VHS, DVD, Blu-ray, whatever. What comes first in the actual story? Chronologically, what do you think it is? Well, the first scene to take place within the story, not the movie, is the Gold Watch. The Gold Watch. The Gold Watch scene with Christopher Walken and Baby Butch. Butch is a little kid. And Christopher Walken is telling young Butch about the backstory, or should I say the back end story?
Wow, that's so funny. Funny. Give her money now.
At first, I was surprised that Walken was only in this movie for one marvelous and important monologue. He did such a wonderful job. He comes onto the scene with a delicate but important mission. Delivering the family heirloom to his fallen war buddy's little boy. He tells young Butch of the Gold Watch and how it was passed down over generations. And now it is Butch's turn to carry on the family legacy, or totem, if you will. And then Christopher Walken delivers one of the funniest moments of the movie by letting little Butch know that the gold valuable watch made it through the war. Butch's dad shoved the watch up his ass. And then Christopher, the captain, shoved it up his ass when Butch's dad died of dysentery. Yuck. War. And you have a family heirloom up your ass. You have your dead friend's watch up his ass. And you're telling his little boy it's his turn to look after this thing. That was the craziest honor-ridden guilt trip I have ever witnessed. Also, I learned a lot of fancy pants cinephile stuff from YouTube. Sorry, that word just freaks me out. I'll get over it. But anyway, I learned a lot of fancy pants cinephile stuff from a YouTube channel called Collective Learning by Bob Ager, who runs this channel. But he has a pretty interesting video about the Gold Watch chapter from this movie. In the video, he points out so many cool little filmmaking details, like all the scenes with Butch have yellow, orange, or gold in it. The apartment complex that Butch needs to return to, the plants look very jungle-like, which is a callback to like what his dad went through, and war is referenced a lot with Butch. I don't know, it's a cool video. So Baby Butch and the Gold Watch open up the story. Then what do you think comes next? Bum bum, after the gold watch. Divine intervention. And God, I love Jules. Jules was my favorite character of the movie. I really liked Vince and of course Mia, but Jules was deep. So Vince and Jules go to this shady apartment complex after they have like this car ride full of like coworker talk. They arrive at this shady apartment complex to get something from these guys. So Vince and Jules go to this shady apartment complex that had an abandoned lobby full of old furniture and an elevator. And for me, that's swanky, inexpensive. You have a lobby with matching furniture that the building put there, and you have a an elevator. But at that time, whatever time it was, this is supposed to be a shitty building. And the elevator did look fucking disgusting. But still, it's like one of those elevators that always has like piss on the floor. If you know, you know. Vince and Jules are on the elevator, and Jules is kind of warning and letting Vince know that Marcellus threw one of his guys off a fourth story floor for touching his wife, Mia, for touching her feet, giving her a foot rub. So Jules is telling this to Vince because Vince is a little stupid and he will be taking Mia out one-on-one per Marcellus's request. Also, feet. This is the first foot that may hint to a foot fetish rumor that Quentin Tarantino has been denying his whole career, I think. I don't think he's ever admitted it, right? And also, I find it very interesting that every fucking detail in this movie is intentional. But the foot glamour is coincidental. Mm-hmm. Just, okay. There's a lot of feet. There's a lot of foot fetish stuff in this movie. I saw it. Dirty soles of feet. There's like a lady dangling a heel, a nice sexy pump off of her toe. They like a lot of naked feet, like a lot of attractive women with naked feet. That's significant. Anyway. So now they're in the apartment with Phil Lamar and those other weird little white boys. And Phil did so good. He's always good. And he looked so scared. I wanted to reach through the screen anytime Jules would yell at Marvin. That's Phil Lamar's character. Anytime Jules would yell at Marvin, I just wanted to reach through the screen. And I just wanted to scoop him up. And I just wanted to whap him in a blanket. And then I just wanted to give him like a cookie and a blunt. Or like whatever he wanted to put on cartoons and just pet his old forehead and just say, go to sleep, little baby. It's all over. But, you know, that's physically impossible. So this scene / part in the story holds so many quotable moments and big moments for Jules. We are introduced to the Kahuna Burger, the briefcase mystery, Ezekiel 25:17, and a possible editing mistake. I really loved this moment in the movie. It was funny, dark, violent, dramatic, and kind of silly sometimes. So, I don't know, maybe we can talk about the briefcase first. Yeah, the briefcase. This is what I thought was inside. Well, at first, I thought it was just money, you know? Maybe even gold because of the gold light. I thought it was gold or money because of the gold light and they're a bunch of gangsters and it's all about money. But then I thought it was something else when Jules showed this briefcase or whatever was inside of it to Pumpkin in the diner. Pumpkin was almost brought to tears when he saw it, but seemed to recognize it like it was an infamous something or another. And it seemed like he never thought he would see that thing in his life. If this was money, I can also see Pumpkin reacting this way. So this made me think it could be an artifact of some kind. But to leave something of that value, only protected by a locked briefcase, to a bunch of sketchy, preppy, drug-dealing white boys in a shitty apartment building who store it under the sink behind pots and pans, it's interesting. And it makes me spiral. I'll say that I like how Quentin Tarantino, like, intentionally leaves this answer a secret or unsolved because we're supposed to come up with it. There's a fan theory that it's the diamonds from the heist in Reservoir Dogs. Maybe it's the Declaration of Independence and everything relates back to Nick Cage. I want to see that. Make it happen. Now, I want to talk about Samuel L. Jackson. Oh, I wish I could put this feeling of admiration for his performance into words. What does Mia say when she goes into the bathroom at Jackrabbit Slim's?
I said, God damn! God damn! God damn!
He sounded Shakespearean in this scene. When he's like giving that Ezekiel line, oh God. And then when he stares into the camera when he's finishing off that soda, that is probably my favorite shot in the entire movie.
Oh, look at me giving fucks about camera angles.
His character has so many moments in this part of the story. He is the shit when he is delivering his famous Ezekiel 25:17 monologue. He effortlessly shoots and kills the kid on the couch, which really sets the tone for the scene. He shuts Marvin up with absolute authority, plays with that weird little fuckboy who thinks he can smooth talk his way out of the situation, only to be scared into only saying the word what?
English.
Hold on. This is me doing my best Jules impression. Are you ready?
English, motherfucker. Do you speak it?
And then when the guy in the bathroom just like busts out and he starts like unloading his gun at Jules and Vince, Jules has a spiritual awakening that eventually changes his life forever. And I just like how cool Jules is. Like, this is the character in the movie that everyone secretly is like, when I grow up, I want to be Jules. You know, even as adults, we're like, God, he's so fucking cool. Like, I thought Vince was this type of cool. Like, before I saw the movie, I thought Vince was supposed to be this type of cool, but I could not be more confused about that. Jules is the cool gangster suit and tie hitman. He's so cool and in control, but then he has a little bit of a soft spot and is emotionally intelligent and has empathy instead of just numb, like most people in his profession. He's pretty cold-blooded when he shoots the kid on the couch, but he's kind and patient with Vince. I feel like he lightened up a little bit with Marvin when they had to leave. You know, like Marvin's like cowering in the corner and he's like, come on, man, let's go. Like, he could have strong-armed him or scared the shit out of him, but he spoke to Marvin like Marvin was this annoying little brother almost. Jules is a badass. A badass motherfucker. But he doesn't lose his shit. He will reprimand, but he keeps it together. And now we're in the car. So we were in the apartment. A lot of shooting happened. Everyone but Marvin, Vince, and Jules is dead. They got the briefcase. And now they're leaving because all of the gunfire in the apartment and the cops are probably coming, you know. So they're just like scooching away and getting out of there. So now we're in the car. We're in like Jules's car. And all the main characters had like these really cool classic cars that just kept throwing me for a loop in regards to like what fucking time period it was. But now we're in Jules's car. Jules and Vince take Marvin with them. And Jules and Vince are having their usual coworker back and forth. Like Jules is driving, Vince is sitting in the passenger seat, and Marvin is in the back. And then Vince accidentally shoots Marvin in the face. I didn't know about this scene in the movie, and I was not expecting it. I didn't know how to react, but I knew I wanted to laugh. The dialogue Vince and Jules have following this incident is on the same tone and intensity as someone accidentally stepping on gum. Not with new shoes, even. Just with shoes that they wear. Like, oh, man. Like, Jules, being the smart one, realizes that his entire back window is covered in blood and gray matter. And now there is a dead body in the car. Way to go, Vince. And they are driving down the highway in broad daylight. So he calls up a partner, the only partner in the area. He doesn't say friend. He doesn't say good friend. He doesn't say buddy. He says partner. And this was important for me and helped me better understand the dynamic between him and this partner. Oh, and the editing mistake from this part of the story. So when that guy jumps out of the bathroom and he unloads his gun and, you know, there's like this big moment when Jules and Vince turn around and they see that the bullets, a lot of them, went into the walls behind them. You know, Vince and Jules were actually untouched. But you can actually see these bullet holes before the guy even jumps out of the bathroom. You see the bullet holes behind Jules in a short clip of him talking to Marvin before this kid jumps out of the bathroom. If this was done on purpose, or if there is a fan theory out there about this, let me know. I actually love the fan theories about this movie. I'll say it, y'all are fucking creative. And this takes us to the next chapter. The Bonnie situation. Okay, so, the Bonnie situation. Enter Jimmy. So just to keep up with the story, Vince and Jules take the car to Jimmy's house, and Jimmy is an old partner of Jules, and according to Quentin Tarantino, Jules and Jimmy worked for Marsalis, and then Jimmy got married to Bonnie, and Bonnie made him quit. That's it. I'm not sure how close they are supposed to be, but it just seems like Jules needs a favor from this fucking weirdo, or else it's the end, and Jules and Vince are headed to the slammer. You know? So, Jimmy. This is the first time I saw Quentin Tarantino act, and it was so strange. I've seen Quentin Tarantino interview, and he's more of a character. You know, he's not like Jimmy, but then he is. But then again, he is. But then again, he isn't. I don't know. I was also looking up some other, well, the other cameos that he did. And I saw the one from, of course, like Reservoir Dogs, Django, right? And like all these other ones. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, he's just a strange actor. And, you know, this is Quentin Tarantino's second film and his acting is not good. I said it. It's okay. You know, I can forgive him for bad acting. There's a lot of controversy around this Jimmy character, by the way. Mainly because he says the N-word a lot while he is going on this enraged rant, and this rant is directed at Jules. Are you fucking kidding me? And people are like, whoa, what? This is weird. And then that prompts other people to be like, he's playing a character in a movie. It's not real. And then boom, there's an entire like Reddit thread. Is that what they call it over there? You know, I read those. I read those conversations that people were having on Reddit. But, I try to stay off Reddit because, like, I'm weirdly afraid of it. And just put things into perspective, I'm also, like, really scared of whales and certain types of reusable straws. Oh, yeah. My mind is a hellscape, baby. Anyway. So, I'm sure someone is out there like, so, where do you stand, Lucky? Well, look. I don't like the defensive arguments for Jimmy because they are all wrong. I saw people saying Jimmy was angry, so he was trying to be as shitty as possible. He was going to be divorced. It's just a movie. There was also rape and murder in this movie, too. Like, do you have a problem with those actors and moments? And even, God, okay. And even this one sounds very white, but it came up more than once. A lot of people were like, well, Quentin Tarantino, his mom dated a lot of black men while he was growing up. Huh? Wrong. This is not. No, that's not why Jimmy said what he said. And also for that last one, I thought we were talking about Jimmy here, not Quentin. It's just the character, right? So, yes. It's just a movie. And Jimmy is just a character. Yeah, he is not the only white person in this movie to use that language or in any of his movies. This word comes up a lot in his movies, doesn't it? But he's not just an actor, and he's the director, and he's also the writer for this movie. And this is what he chose for his cameo. So yeah, people are going to question it. They're really going to look into it. They're really going to read into it. And that's not a bad thing. People should question stuff like this and like have some critical thinking about this. I think that's fine. But this is how I made this like Jimmy situation makes sense for me in my brain. It wasn't necessarily like the language Jimmy was using. That's not what was throwing me off. A white guy throwing down a hard ER. Yeah, that's not surprising to me. It wasn't the language that was throwing me off. It was the power dynamic between Jimmy and Jules that confused the fuck out of me. I was confused as to why Jules. And at this point in the movie, and also in the story, you see Jules have this big badass moment in this fucking shitty apartment complex. He just fucking shoots people in cold blood, and he like uses Bible verses as a kiss of death, and like, and then just to see him go to Jimmy and be like, okay man, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I was confused as to why Jules was buttering him up so much, and why he was cowering Well, I said it before. Jules needs something, a big something from Jimmy. So Jules needs to play nice and let the weirdo that he knows well enough to go on this his little nasty racist hissy fit and then move on. But when I first saw this, I have a confession. When I first saw this, I didn't really pay attention to all the dialogue in the pink bathroom because when I saw the pink bathroom, I was transported back in time in my brain where I had a pink bathroom like that. And it was actually from the turn of the century and it was really fucking fantastic. It had pink tile floors, pink tile walls. It also had a pink bathtub and a pink toilet and a pink sink. And then boom, Jimmy is just dropping the N-bomb. And I'm like, whoa. That was my experience with watching that for the first time. I was like, hello, what are we doing? Yeah. So how do I feel about Jimmy? I feel that he's a racist. Jimmy's racist. And y'all, he's not screaming the N-word because he's angry. He doesn't use language like that because he's angry. He says it because he's racist and angry. I think it's okay to call Jimmy racist. And I don't know why it wouldn't. Because who fucking talks like that? Scumbags. Jules calms Jimmy down while he is also trying to babysit Vince through the situation that is 100% Vince's fault. Jules calls Marsalis, and instead of yelling at Jules for this stupid mistake, Marsalis sends the best of the best, the wolf, to clean it up. And the wolf is a fun character and part of this story slash lifestyle. And the wolf, he's the cleaner-upper. You got a problem, you got a dead body. He comes, cleans it up in record time, and it makes the situation look like nothing ever happened. No one will have questions to ask. We can all move on. And I want to say that this part of the movie was so gross. And everyone is totally okay with it. They're totally okay with the brain fragments in Jules' hair that sit there until the wolf hoses the boys down and Jimmy gives them some comfy but embarrassing clothes to wear. And Jimmy, during the hose off, just kind of solidified with me that Jimmy's an awkward weirdo. But I think we also see a bit of Quentin Tarantino kind of peek through when he's directing the wolf where to spray the hose. I'm gonna be really honest. I really like the clothes that they change into. Not really because of how they look. Well, the banana slug shirt is, I want that. But damn, they look comfy and at ease. And they're in LA, so a gift shop shirt, jogging shorts, and flip-flops must feel amazing. God, and they must feel amazing after having to wear a suit drenched in blood and brains. Oh, and then you get to sit on expensive fresh linens on the drive over to Hawthorne Diner. You see, that's what we like to call a smooth transition. Oh, it's Hawthorne Grill. God damn it. So much for being smooth. Okay, let's go over to the Hawthorne Grill. Jules and Vince pull into the Hawthorne Grill after gathering the suitcase and being handled by the wolf, right? And now they're having a discussion. They've sat down at a booth because that is prime time dining experience. If you go with me to a diner or a grill and you don't ask for a booth, or we don't ask for a booth, or God forbid we get one of those half booth, half table monstrosities, I'm going to be bummed. I'm going to be inconsolable. Inconsolable, I think is the word. Whatever. They're sitting down in a booth and they're having this discussion about this crazy divine intervention situation that happened back at the crummy apartment. Jules tells Vince that he has made up his mind to quit the job because this divine intervention is, you know, is a sign to him. He can't ignore it. So he wants to quit the job and he just wants to go wherever his heart or the wind takes him because he just can't ignore this. He can't ignore this divine sign of this magnitude. So Vince goes to the potty, which people point out all the time. I didn't notice how often Vince needs the bathroom, but people are always wondering why he's always on the go. And some people have explained that it could be due to his addiction. You know, you have an addiction. It's not like you can just use in the middle of wherever you're at. You got to go get some privacy, and that's the bathroom. And also, people were saying that he might need more bathroom time, not only because of the heroin, but because of the heroin. Like, the heroin makes you constipated. So the more you know, I guess.
I didn't even realize he was going to the bathroom that much. I go to the bathroom a lot. That's because I care about my colon health and I have 3 holes to take care of.
What is it? Too much information?
I don't give a fuck. After Vince walks off to the bathroom, a couple named Pumpkin and Honey Bunny that are sitting in another booth, they jump up from their booth and they start sticking up the place. They start collecting wallets and money from the register. Everyone is panicked, except for Jules. Jules eventually is approached by Pumpkin at gunpoint, and Pumpkin quickly gets a greeting from Jules and his 45. Jules doesn't shoot. In fact, he opens his heart. Metaphorically, Jesus Christ, metaphorically, he opens his heart. Quentin Tarantino movies are fucking gory as hell. He metaphorically opens his heart, and he tells Pumpkin about Ezekiel 25:17. He said that he always would say it because it sounded cool, and he used it like a kiss of death. Once you heard it, you knew it was the last thing you were going to hear. And then he goes on to how he now has like a new understanding for this verse. And he lets Pumpkin know that basically if it were one day earlier or even earlier this morning, Pumpkin would be carved by Jules's bullets. Also, all this violent shit happens in the morning. The apartment, the grill, the wolf, this robbery. Like we're still serving breakfast, y'all. But Jules is on a new path. Jules gives Pumpkin and Honey Bunny around $1,500 or something from his own wallet and sends them on their way. Oh, by the way, his wallet says badass motherfucker on it. Perfect. And then after Pumpkin and Honey Bunny leave, after a stick up, after some persuasion, some arguing, some yelling, you know, Jules and Vince start to make their way over to Marcellus at the strip club. And this scene was so fun. It was so fun, so cool. Not only is it the opening and closing scene of the movie, but it made me laugh. It made me laugh so hard. And also, just what another cool moment for Jules. I thought Honey Bunny was very, very funny and amazing. So in the first scene of the movie, we see Honey Bunny and Pumpkin at this table in the diner, and they're having their dialogue about robbing the place. Then they jump up and they draw their weapons and they're like, "This is a stick up." And Honey Bunny has this badass line that's something like, "Nobody move or I'll shoot every last one of you, see?" And then we hear that amazing guitar intro that's like, "Damn, blah, 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 blah." That it's such a badass opening for a movie. It's such a badass like moment for an actor. It's a badass moment for a character. It just really sets the tone, you know, like, oh, we're in for a ride. And like no wonder people were like, whoa, this is great. But at the end of the movie, in the last scene in this diner with Jules, Honey Bunny jumps up. When she jumps up, she's not only does she say something different, it has like a whole different vibe. So she jumps up and she sounds like a Tasmanian devil and, you know, delivers like this different chaotic line, and she's all over the place. And so instead of being like really smooth and in control and being like, "Nobody move," she's more like, like and some people say that this is different and it's different on purpose because the scene at the end of the movie could be from Jules's point of view, which, you know, makes sense. When I heard that, I was like, does that mean that badass start of the movie is her point of view? Because that's funny. Like, you know, she delivers this cool line and the opening credits take off with this badass guitar song. And like, and that's how she feels in the moment. When she goes to retell this story later, she's gonna make herself look so fucking cool. But in reality, is she just like a loud spitting mess? And her, "I have to pee and I wanna go home." That line, those words will be tattooed on my neck within a week. Or I'll make a shirt. I'll probably just make a shirt. Yeah. I don't need to tattoo that on my body. Oh, yeah, I do. I do need a tattoo. Anyway. Oh, and there's a little bit of an Easter egg at the beginning of the movie. So the beginning of the movie, when Pumpkin and Honey Bunny are talking to each other in the booth, there's this like shot. It's when the camera's on Honey Bunny, kind of when the conversation starts going. So you see Honey Bunny, but then over her shoulder, you can see Vince walking to the bathroom. Like you see the back of him, you see his hair, the shorts, the shirt, the book. That's so fun. And that happens at the beginning of the movie. So, so fun. Anyway, off to the strip club to deliver this suitcase to the big boss.
Woohoo, now we're at the strip club with Marcellus, but it's during the day because it's still the fucking morning time, so the strip club is closed and empty, and there's a bartender there, his name's Paul, and he has a fun little line. My name's Paul, and this is between y'all. And he said that to, like, keep himself out of a conversation. I thought that was fun. Anyway, so the scene opens up with grown-up Butch, played by Bruce Willis. We see grown-up Butch, and he's sitting down at the table in this empty, closed strip club with all this red lighting that's probably setting the tone for how angry Butch is getting during this conversation that he's having with Marcellus. Because Marcellus... Is it Marcellus or Marcellus? What's my deal? Marcellus. So Marcellus is basically telling Butch, the boxer, remember, that when he goes up against Marcellus's fighter, Butch, he's going to throw the fight. He's going to take a loss, get his ass beat, so Marcellus can win the pool or pot. You know, like the money from the gambling. I don't gamble. I don't know what it's called. Marcellus kind of shit-talks Butch as well as a boxer. Like, he's shit-talking him and tells him to, like, swallow his pride and be the man for the job. When Marcellus goes to hand over the envelope again to Butch, Butch puts his, like, he grabs it, but Marcellus still doesn't let go, so Butch still has to, like, yank it away after he kind of agreed to do the job. Like, Marcellus was like, are you my guy? And then Butch was like, yes, seems so. And it's not like a solid yes, but I mean, it's words that came out of his mouth. Then enter Jules and Vince in their silly little outfits and flip-flops. Then Vince gets in a conversation with Paul, right? So while Butch is talking to Marcellus, whatever, Vince goes up to the bar and he starts to talk with Paul, the bartender, about taking Mia out, right? Per Marcellus's request. And everyone in there is like giggling at Vince. As if he's, like, about to walk into a trap with Mia. And this is where the Mia test fan theory comes in. The big question is, why would a man like Marcellus, a guy with endless fortune, need a silly willy like Vince? Like, why would he need him, a guy like that, to take his beautiful, new, unpredictable wife out on a not date? Fans think that Marcellus is using Mia as a test, a loyalty test, that one of his guys already failed. So the theory is that Vince was away in Amsterdam for a few years, and during that time, Marcellus and Mia met and got married. So Jules, in the weird apartment building, when they're going up that stinky elevator, Jules, you know, he was like warning Vince. Remember, by telling him what happened to Tony Rocky Horror, the foot rub guy, because Vince is a good guy, but a big old dum-dum, but, you know, he probably deserves to pass the test. And I agree. I agree that Mia was a loyalty test. I hate to think that Mia is used as a test, but isn't aware herself that she is a test. But I don't think that is the case, and I don't think that could be the case. I do like to think that she is aware of her role in this test. And honestly, that makes the most sense. And she is a smart girl. So she would have found out eventually, and she seems disturbed and lonely enough to be totally into this idea anyway. Or what if she doesn't know it's a test? Or maybe she is really lonely, and she's like really this lonely and might really need a babysitter or a good time, but hates the rumor that she is a test and throws herself at men. So maybe that's why she gets defensive at Jackrabbit Slims. Or maybe she gets defensive to throw Vince off her scent. So back to Butch. Seeing Butch at this point in this story is probably one of the reasons why the movie is shown out of order. Because last time we saw Butch, he was opening up the story at age 5, and we don't see him again until now when he's an adult. And since we have seen so much head explosions, the wolf, the grill, the divine intervention, we would probably be confused at to who Butch, honestly, Bruce Willis, like we would be confused as to who that guy is, both as a child and even as an adult. It's like, well, then what was that kid about? Who is this guy? Oh, that was the kid. Like, you know what I mean? It just like, I don't think it would read well. Me, like, this is my thoughts, as if I didn't read this explanation. But no, I think this explanation makes sense.
Like, telling it out of order, good idea. And Vince is so rude to Butch in this moment. He calls him names that basically make Butch seem like a little bitch boy boxer sellout. And that's gonna bite Vince in the ass, or in the chest, later. Jack Rabbit Slims. That's where we're at now. Everyone gather around. We are now at the iconic scene, the scene that everyone talks about, the scene where all the clips are from, the scene that made me think that this movie was set in the 50s. This is the not date night with Mia between Mia and Vince. And this is where Mia proves she is a cool girl. Also, I like how Vincent is high and he's just like walking through an environment like this. So a few things about this scene. I think we all know what goes down in this scene. The two sit at the table that's inside of a really cool car. There's a lot of tension between Mia and Vince, and Mia is looking at Vince like a spider looking at a fly caught in a web. There's talk of comfortable silences, what went down with the foot rub, the characters walking around. I really enjoyed this scene. It was very colorful, it was very fun. But when I first watched it, I'm not going to lie, I thought the dance scene was going to be a bit more epic. I was expecting more from the dance scene. I didn't, you know, realize it was going to be so simple and short. But, you know, it works. And I see why it's so remembered. Like, it's a really fun moment of the scene. And for some reason, I guess just the hype and the way people remember it and then would tell it back to me, it just seemed like it was like so much bigger and flashier. But right when I think it was about to take off, the scene just like fades out to black. And I was like, oh, we're done. Okay. But there is a little fun fact about this scene and a few weird takeaways from my first watch. Steve Buscemi was in this scene. He was Buddy Holly, the waiter. And this moment made me happy that I watched Reservoir Dogs. I ended up watching Reservoir Dogs because I was just hearing about all the overlap. I was happy to see Steve Buscemi was now portraying Buddy Holly, or just like some kid that plays Buddy Holly at this like themed restaurant. Steve Buscemi's character in Reservoir Dogs had a shit take on tipping waitresses. So, of course, it's funny that he cameos in this movie as a shitty waiter. Vince even says he's not that good. And he's also a little rude when he's taking the orders. But he is almost unrecognizable in his black wig. And I think he looks good in a black wig. When they're on the stage and Mia is like holding the mic and she's like, oh, Vince Vega. You can see Buddy Holly, Steve Buscemi in the background, just like checking women out. And I want to take this moment to say Uma Thurman knows how to hold a cigarette. She doesn't do this weird open palm thing. Have you seen that? Actors will hold a cigarette, but their entire hand, all five fingers, straight. They're all straight. Have you seen that? That has always driven me crazy. I've never seen someone out in the wild smoke like that. I only see actors do it. Even really good actors do it. Maybe some people like literally just can't hold something with two fingers and then make the rest of the fingers on that hand relaxed. So maybe I'm up my ass about this. I don't know. But Uma has good cigar acting techniques, like how she uses her thumb to point at herself. Like she's still smoking, right? She has her cigarette and she's delivering this cool line like, I think Marcella's told you to take me out. And when she goes and take me out, she has the cigarette in her hand. She takes her thumb and she points at herself. And she looks so cool just using her thumb just to be like me, the smoking cigarette in the same hand. It's just so cool. And then she's like, we're going to go up there. We're going to dance. We're going to get that trophy. So be good or something. And using your thumb to point at yourself is a cool power move. People only use their thumbs to point at themselves when they're like the boss, but they use a finger to point at themselves when they're like, who, me? And it's a lot of wrist action, a lot of unnecessary wrist. Can you hear my wrist cracking? That's me using a finger to point at me. Me? But when they use their thumb to point at themselves, it isn't like a who, me? Who, me? Who, me? It's just me, you know?
Oh, and there was more naked feet in this scene, more naked lady feet in this scene. But I was more appalled at Vince and Mia when they kicked off their shoes. So they go on stage and they're about to do their little, they're about to bring the fucking house down with their twist and their mobile joints. But I was appalled when Vince and Mia took off their shoes and they placed them at the edge of the stage, which is actually, so the stage is surrounded by booths. If you're sitting by a booth by the stage literally is touching your, like your, the booth is like nailed into the stage. So when you're sitting at the booth, from your neck up is the stage, right? So they kick off their shoes and they take the shoes to the edge of the stage and it's like near people eating.
And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, I could be overreacting. I could be reading a little too far into this. I could be a prude. But Mia, her shoe of choice for this LA evening were flats, metallic gold flats. And flats are the stinkiest and grimiest of all shoes. And maybe I don't want toe cheese in my face when I'm trying to eat my double deluxe speed burger.
So now that we are talking about Uma, turns out she wasn't the first pick to play the part of Mia. But she was Quentin's pick, which is all that really matters when it comes to a Quentin Tarantino film. Apparently, Uma was a model turned actress, and Pulp Fiction made her into an A-list celebrity overnight. Fucking sweet, right? Speaking of this movie changing careers, John Travolta. Apparently, this movie saved his career, and he wasn't the first pick for the part. So John was a big hotshot in Hollywood. Heartthrob in the 70s, right? And then his career started to take some weird twists and turns in the 80s, and he just ended up in talking baby movies. Happens to us all. Michael Madsen, Mr. Blonde from Reservoir Dogs, Michael Madsen was the first pick for Vince, but he had signed on to another commitment and the shoots were happening at the same exact time, so he had to pass. In fact, he says that it was neat to see John up there on screen doing this dancing scene, right? Because it would have been completely and entirely different movie if, you know, Michael Madsen had to get up there and dance. I think he's a little more self-conscious in that area. And John Travolta, you know, he's got this big dancing background, especially dancing in movies and dancing on screen. So, but it also just makes me think, like, what would it be like for Michael Madsen to play a big ol' screw up like Vince? John Travolta nailed it. Back to the story, back to the Tarantinoverse. So they win the first place trophy, right? And she gets a trophy to match her gold little shoes. And they are back at the Wallace residence, and Vince goes to the bathroom so he can talk himself out of trouble for once. Jules is the one that usually is talking sense into Vince. But now Jules isn't there, so now Vince is talking sense into Vince. Either way, he's in the bathroom for way too fucking long. By the time he comes out of the bathroom, Mia has had a solo dance moment, found his baggie of $3,000 heroin that's packaged like coke in his pocket, snorted a line, probably had some horrible seizures, and fell on the floor and is now foaming at the mouth. He like literally comes out the bathroom, he's like, hey, like this whole speech he's had planned. Hey, Mia, I think I really gotta get, oh shit, like literally. And I was so blown away by Uma in this scene. That single tear that slid down her cheek as she was starting to lose consciousness on the couch. God, this was a moment. This is also just like a fun movie moment. It's not fun, but it's like one of those moments that makes me like movies because I was talking at the screen. I was in there. I was like, my girl is under attack. She needs help. And I knew, even not having ever before seen this movie, I know she gets into some kind of trouble like this because I knew about the adrenaline needle. But I knew this would happen because, you know, this moment's so well known. And I still was like, no, Mia, no, please, no. You know, she just wanted to party. And then she was laying on the floor and her eyes were fucked up. Like they were red and they were just full of tears. Like there was like walls of just tears in her eyes. Like how did she do that?
Did they use that burning balm that makes people cry or irritating like eye drops or something? You know, I could have looked this up, but apparently my research time was taken up by rage researching, and I'll talk about that later. You know, I was blown away by that moment. Like, it looked pretty convincing. And then, and then she had all that vom in her mouth. Gross, gross. So Vince scoops Mia up, puts her in his really cool car, and he's like flying through the streets of LA on the way to his drug dealer's house, Lance. And he does so in a very chill, calm, cool, collected manner by basically soft crashing his car into Lance's garage or something and dragging and dropping Mia's limp body through the front yard while getting into a screaming match with Lance. And Lance lives in a pretty suburban middle-class neighborhood. Yeah, very calm, cool, and chill, Vince. This is Vince without Jules. My God. They bring her into the house, and panic breaks out because there's Lance in the house. Lance has his wife there, and his wife has like a friend there, and they're talking about piercings, fellatio, drugs, whatever. And then boom, Vince just comes screeching in later that night and fucks up the vibe, right? So yeah, so they bring her in, panic breaks out, and eventually Mia gets a 10-inch needle and a full syringe of adrenaline to the heart. Typical night out.
Did you know
that a part of this scene was filmed in reverse? You probably did, because I am new to this. This scene, a part of it was like literally just like a quick little second of it was filmed in reverse. It happens very, very quickly. It's when Vince actually is like plunging the needle downward. And it was decided to film this in reverse because the other Hollywood magic tricks, like a fake breastplate and stuff, like that just wasn't looking great. It wasn't sounding great. And it just wasn't reading the way Quentin Tarantino wanted it. I looked this scene up on YouTube. And on YouTube, you can control the playback speed. So I slowed it down to as slow as it can go. A big tell with reversed footage is the hair and flowy clothing that seems to move like before the body. And everyone in that scene, you know, has like long hair, suit jackets, robes. They're wearing like big pajama shirts and stuff like that. All that jazz. I almost didn't believe it was reversed after all, because the rules of physics seemed to be applied. I was looking really hard. But Lance, the drug dealer's movements were a bit out of order. Not like he could control it. You know, he was wearing a baggy robe, baggy PJs, and he had long hair. So he had a triple whammy. And the shot is not even like the actual film shot. Like, it's not even a second long. Like, it's very, it's so quick. And if you slow the clip down and you watch him, you can see that he jumps, you know, when the needle is plunging towards Mia's heart. Amazing reaction from the actor. I mean, that's what you do. They all kind of jump, right? But if you're looking at the robe, more or less like around his shoulders, it moves a little right before he moves, right before he starts to jump. His robe just kind of, like laws of physics, that doesn't make sense. I don't know shit about laws of physics. I just know when you move, your clothes move. It's not like your clothes move, you move. I just want to say this little bit of it is just done so well. And all the actors in the scene handled this movie magic thing like a bunch of professionals. Because they are professionals. This is still my favorite scene in the movie. And then Uma's performance was so cool. It was dramatic and probably not realistic. I feel like she should have had a lot of brain damage by this point, but I don't think that's really how you revive somebody. But it was dramatic, probably not realistic, but it looked and it felt real and it was dramatic. And it's kind of the result we wanted, right? There was all this buildup for the scene, and it's like, she better damn well come back to life and be okay and gasp and breathe and have the syringe just dangling from her chest. And the following shot of Vince and Uma and the car drive back to the Wallace residence. Just seeing Vince and Uma sit next to each other in that car just provides this whole new type of comfortable silence for the night. And that's where we leave Mia. See? Seems like she would be in the movie for more than the first half, but, you know, she wasn't. So after the night out with Mia, it's the night of the fight. So I guess it's the next night. I don't know. Just after that night out with Mia,
The next part of the story, the night of the fight. The fight that Butch was paid to throw. Instead, Butch places all the bets on him and he ends up killing Marcellus's fighter in the ring. And he takes the winning pot and he jumps out of a window and he catches a ride with a familiar cabbie. The cab driver from this scene is Esmeralda Villalobos, who was a character in a short film Quentin made called Curdled. In the movie Curdled, she kind of had the same job as the wolf, like, you know, like cleaning up murders and stuff. And she ended up becoming obsessed with murder and looked at it like it was an exciting art. So I feel like she was lying a little bit when she was like, "Ooh, you're the first person I ever met that's killed someone." And then she's asking him, like, what it feels like to kill somebody and is anticipating everything Butch says. He gives her, like, lackluster answers. And Butch takes the cab back to a motel where his lady waits for him, Fabienne. Fabienne is cute. She has a face from the 1920s and a haircut from the 70s. And she adores Butch. When I watched this the first time, I did not realize she was trying to tell Butch that she was pregnant. I thought she was just loving on chubby women with their bellies and her little, "I really want a pot belly" kind of moment. And I thought she was joking when she was listing everything she wanted for breakfast. And then I thought she had bad writing when she just started to cry at the end instead of just jumping on the back of that motorcycle. You know, he's like, "Come on, baby, we gotta go." And she just like starts crying. And I'm just like, what is this? It's like, oh, she's pregnant. That literally had to be explained to me. I'll get better at watching movies, I promise. But the babe is babed. She's pregnant. So Butch and Fabienne are sitting on the bed of the motel the next day after the fight. And Fabienne is aware that Butch might have fucked up with the wrong people, but focuses on their exciting plans to leave town and travel the world. Butch starts to put on like more leisurely clothes, like a button-down shirt, and he's digging through his suitcase when he notices that his watch, the gold watch, is missing. And it looks like Fabienne forgot to pack the watch. So he just loses his shit. Full-grown baby man freak out. Sure, it's an heirloom. That watch has been through a lot and a lot of people. But throwing the TV in a rental? Butch. Come on. Well, he did, you know, the typical thing. Throw a big fit, yelling, calling her stupid and a dumb whore and like throwing the television, throwing shit around, screaming, stomping around. And then he just like immediately changes his demeanor and he just like goes over to her and just apologizes to his shell-shocked partner who was crouched and afraid in the corner. Yeah, because that's really gonna smooth over the situation. So then Butch just knows that he's just gonna have to go back to the apartment. He takes off his button-down t-shirt. And he puts on a good old white t-shirt and his suede jacket that has gold lining. And then he goes back to his apartment. And then we get to the Pop-Tart scene. And there are so many fan theories about this one, too. And they're pretty fun. This is where I start to see and understand how the fans had so much fun with this movie. Not only was this movie a puzzle to put together, each scene has a little storytelling Easter eggs in it. Quentin Tarantino wrote this in a way where whoever watched could piece together the story for themselves. We get to figure out how to put this movie into chronological order. Some scenes had no dialogue, you know, but a clear exchange between characters that provided a plot development. And what wasn't said in the dialogue is said in the clues placed in the scene. When Butch shoots Vince, this is a great example of this, and it's pretty fun to pick apart. This is what made me understand why this movie is talked about so much. So Butch goes back to his apartment to get his precious butthole watch. He finds the watch almost immediately, and then he sticks around. This gave me so much anxiety. He just sticks around to eat some Pop-Tarts, and I love Pop-Tarts, specifically the dollar store brand Toast and Pop-Ups, but get the fuck out of there. Get the fuck out of there. You got your watch. Get the fuck out of, like,
If you have to quietly insert a key into a lock, you're going into a room that you need to leave immediately. So Butch goes into the kitchen, aggressively and noisily rips open the Pop-Tarts, slams them in the metal toaster. Then he looks to his left, and on the counter is a big, fat gun. He picks up the gun, and he inspects it. Then the bathroom door opens, and it's Vince, the guy who was rude to him at the strip club. The two exchange cowboy standoff stares, and then the Pop-Tarts pop out of the toaster, and then Butch just lets loose and just fills Vince with, like, bullets and just shoots the shit out of him. And it sends Vince back into the bathroom from whence he came. So after the Pop-Tart scene, Butch drives off thinking he's set. Also, I do want to mention, during this point when he's and he, like, shoots Vince, he, like, looks down at the gun. At first, you know, I'm not good at, like, context clues, apparently. At first, I was like, why is he looking at the gun like, who did that? You know what I mean? He's looking at the gun like, not like, who did that, but who am I? Am I my dad? Is this what my dad did? Is this what war is like? Did I really just shoot somebody? And then he, like, looks into the bathroom and he's like, oh my God. And then, you know, and then he leaves. So after the Pop-Tart scene, Butch drives off thinking he's set. And then he stops at a crosswalk. He's jamming to the radio and he sees Marcellus fucking crossing the street. And Marcellus, I keep going back and forth from calling him Marcellus and Marcellus, and I'm so fucking sorry. But so he stops at the stopwalk and he sees Marcellus cross the street, and Marcellus recognizes Butch right away. And then Butch floors it and hits Marcellus with his car. And a lot of fans had so many questions and so many answers about this scene. Who does that fat gun belong to? Why didn't Vince hear Butch aggressively prepare Pop-Tarts? Well, I have a few fun theories to share with you. Let's talk about the gun. The fans gathered that this gun could belong to Vince. The fans can easily imagine Vince leaving the gun out on the counter to go use the bathroom, because Vince at this point has a strong reputation for being a little, a little what? Dumb. But there is another theory that this gun belongs to Marcellus. Fans theorize that Marcellus is joining Vince on the stakeout because Vince's partner, Jules, has retired from the game. So that's one theory. And I'm not done with that one, but that's one theory. And then we have the next one that's like, why didn't Vince hear Butch aggressively prepare those motherfucking Pop-Tarts? Because if that last theory is true, then Vince thinks that Marcellus is in the kitchen. He's returning from going out to get donuts and coffee. And before Butch hits Marcellus with his car, you can see Marcellus is walking across the street, minding his own business, and he's holding a pink cardboard donut box, and two coffee cups are sitting on top of the box. And they are still in Butch's neighborhood. And it just explains why Marcellus is even there in that neighborhood. What, you think he just likes that Dunkin' Donuts and he just likes going there and they just don't have a coffee cup big enough for him so he has to get two coffees? Is that what you think? No, he's there getting donuts and coffee for him and his employee. So he is with Vince because his partner is gone and it's breakfast time, and because all of these gangsters are early birds, Marcellus goes out to get some coffee and donuts. Some fans think it was strategic. It was a strategic move for the big boss to go out for the goodies and then leave the hitman behind. Because Vince is the man who works out in the streets and has the experience, and as a part of his job, he has to be expendable sometimes. Speaking of this big boss henchman relationship, let's go back to the gun. Some fans say the gun belongs to Vince. Some say the gun could belong to Marcellus and he left it there because it's so fucking big. Why would you take that into a donut shop unless you're about to rob the place? Right? A stronger theory, fans say that the gun is definitely Vince's because he is the muscle. And this big ass gun is for the hitman, right? And it's customary in gangster etiquette, I don't know, for the boss to pack something a bit more concealed, like a pistol. But how fun is all of that? so much fun. Everyone's like coming up with ideas, solving mysteries. Everyone probably has like that weird board on their wall with string pointing to different points, and they're all going crazy like Charlie Day in the mailroom. This was a really good story and a good time. I'll give you that, Quentin Tarantino. And you created a fictional movie that also is a real life game. So that's pretty fucking cool. This brings us to the pawn shop scene. So Bruce hits Marcellus with his car. Marcellus goes flying into the windshield, and I think he like even rolls over top of the car. And then, but Bruce Willis is like still flooring it and not driving away. He just floors it, and he just runs into a building that's on like on the other side of the intersection. And everyone around this Dunkin' Donuts is like, oh my God, what a crazy accident. All these women run to the scene. They run to Marcellus and they're like, oh my God, you poor baby. Oh my God, what happened? And Marcellus is just like, and then Kathy Griffin makes a cute little appearance. And she goes, you know, I am a great lawyer. She either says she knows a great lawyer or that she is a great lawyer. I think she says she is a great lawyer and that he definitely has a case. And and then he looks across the intersection and he sees Bruce, and Bruce sees him, and they both realize that they're both still alive. And then all the women are just like, they don't know Marcellus's name, but they're like, Marcellus, are you okay? Oh my God, oh my God. And like, and then he just pulls out a gun, and the women are like, fuck this. And then Marcellus points the gun at Bruce. All the like the two women that were around his car, like one lady was like opening up his door, and like and another lady was like trying to treat him a little bit, and then fucking Marcellus just starts firing, and he shoots one lady in the hip, and oh my God, the sound that she lets out, it wasn't a scream that you usually get from like a female extra or female character in like a Hollywood movie. No, this lady was like, my hip! Ow! You shot me in my hip! Like, she had a really big guttural scream. It sounded really real and really great. And I always think about her. Every time I watch this movie, I'm like, the lady that gets shot in the hip is one of my favorite ladies. She made it look cool. It made an impression on me. So, you know. Then I think they take off on foot. Yeah, because the car is fucked up. Marcellus never had a car. Coffee, donuts, fuck it. Who knows where the hell they went? And so they start chasing each other through the streets, and they're both fucked up. Like, Butch is fucked up from the crash. Marcellus is fucked up from being fucking hit by a car. And Bruce Willis is now soaked in blood. Soaked in blood. And Marcellus is running and chasing him and shooting after him. And then they like go into this pawn shop full of racist motherfuckers, and they're like fighting around in the pawn shop, and then they're held up at gunpoint by the pawn shop owner. And then he calls some stupid little shit called Zed, and he's like, Zed, spiders caught the fly. Or something like that. Something stupid. Fucking idiot. I hate them. I hate them so much. And you're supposed to hate them. You're supposed to hate them. It's okay to hate a rapist, racist character. If they were even just one of the two, it's okay to hate them. It's speculated that this movie is like Deliverance, a movie that contains a lot of backwoods rape. I haven't seen it, but it's very heavy, you know? And I don't want to talk about this part, but I will say a few things about it. I wish he had chosen the chainsaw. Actually, there were three chainsaws there, and they were compact and mini, and you could actually have one on each hand. I know they're like loud and you can't really sneak up on them, but I just really wish the chainsaw was chosen. Who knows? Maybe Marcellus's guys pick up the chainsaws on their way down to the basement. I hope they do. Butch goes down, saves Marcellus, and they settle their squabble, and Butch is let off the hook. And Marcellus handles shit. I wish we would have seen that. I wish we would have seen what else would have happened to Zed. Bruce rides away on the chopper, which belonged to Zed, the racist, rapist cop that is now in for it. So Butch takes the bike and he drives up to that little motel to pick up Fabienne. And she's like, whose bike is this? And he's like, it's a chopper, baby. And then he has a really good iconic line. She's like, okay, whose chopper is this?
And he said, Zed's. This is Zed's chopper. And she goes, who's Zed? And he says, Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead. And then they ride off into the sunset. And that is the end of the Pulp Fiction story in regards to this movie. I don't know if it continues in another movie because I haven't seen past this movie. Let's wrap it up, shall we? So, yeah. Yeah, dude. I did not give this movie a chance. I didn't. I know on my social media, you probably saw me have a good time in my little recap videos by gasping and being pretty swept up in it. But I was really stubborn about appreciating it, like to the point to where, like, when I was doing my research, I was like trying to research to dig up dirt that would prove that me hating this movie was like justified. And I had a reason to hate this movie. But the reason that I was so against the movie was just because of how I was treated because I didn't watch it. I felt that if I said, this movie is overrated or something like that, that I would feel like, I don't know, like I was thinking for myself and that I'm not an asshole in the bar or that asshole I dated who judged me for not watching this movie. Fuck you, by the way. Or maybe it was a petty way of standing up for myself. And I had this mindset literally until a few days ago. So while I'm researching and like rage researching and even watching the documentary, that QT8 documentary, which I don't think is very good, I had this mindset. And I tell you, I was a hater. I was a hater. Hearing people call Quentin Tarantino a genius and Pulp Fiction a masterpiece over and over and over and over and over again just drove me crazy. So let me tell you what changed all of this in a week. So the thing that helped me enjoy this movie a little bit more, the thing that helped me open up a little bit more, the thing that helped me relax a little bit more was, and I highly recommend this if you haven't tried doing this little trick yet, what I did was watching the movie like it's a movie. Not like it's supposed to be this masterpiece. And I had such a smug attitude, like, huh, let me see what everyone's talking about. Like, I was on a mission to, like, not watch the movie. But that makes sense, though, because I've kind of been on that mission for the past couple decades. Like, I didn't watch this movie out in protest. I was like, no, I'm not watching this fucking movie. You want me to watch this movie? No. I'm not going to watch this fucking movie because if I watch this fucking movie, then I'm going to end up like you. And do I want to be like you? No, because you hurt me. And do I want to hurt me? No. So why the fuck would I watch this movie just to be like fucking you? Yeah, I'll go on a second date with you. After watching Pulp Fiction over and over and doing all of this research, I was getting worked up. And my partner, my baby, my sweet boyfriend, Tarek, heard all of it. All of my opinions, good and enraged, all of the research I was doing, all the Easter eggs in the movie, etc. Just like all my thoughts and feelings and me trying to convince myself that I was right. Everything. He heard everything for hours. But he was amazing, you know, as always. And super supportive, and he wanted to watch the movie with me so I can tell him more. Tell him more, can you believe it? Tell him more about the Easter eggs and the fun facts and all the other shit, and like, let's watch the movie and talk about it while we're watching the movie. So we made a little bit of a date night out of it. We set some time aside, and we had a little double feature movie date. We watched Reservoir Dogs first, and then we watched Pulp Fiction. We ordered some good burgers in honor of the Kahuna Burger moment, got some sodies, some soda, and we only drink soda on special occasions. And then I had an edible, and we snuggled up on the couch with fluffy blankets and just watched these movies and had a good time.
So we watched Reservoir Dogs,
then Pulp Fiction. You know, it's time to watch Pulp Fiction, and Pulp Fiction played. And I was excited. my baby and I were watching and we're calling out all the little details we saw. We're laughing at Vince for being so stupid. really enjoying Samuel L. Jackson and literally every shot that he was in. And I think that's when it hit, not only the audible, but like just that's when it just clicked in my brain. I like this movie and I put so much pressure on myself to be this movie critic when that is not what I'm trying to do here. I just want to watch movies. You know, I got this really long fucking list. I haven't been able to like set time and actually watch these fucking movies. And I just wanted to watch these fucking movies and maybe, you know, like look up some movie magic and fun facts or whatever interests me. Literally, like this critical shit and this pressure on myself to have all the answers and the hot takes and the intelligent attention to detail, I guess is what you would call it. But honestly, no one knows who I am. And here I am going out of my way to be stubborn and uptight. And it also makes me the movie watching asshole. God, because I wasn't watching the movie. Like, I just wasn't watching the movie. Just watch the fucking movie, dude. Just watch the fucking movie. You don't have points to prove. You don't have to have, like, all the answers. You don't need to know exactly what the movie's about. You can be lost. You can be confused. You can feel. You can do whatever. You can do. You just watch it. Just watch the movie. Like, enjoy yourself. I had no idea I had such an issue with this. I knew I had a little trouble, but Pulp Fiction made me realize I have a really big issue with this. I have an issue with enjoying myself and taking it easy. So once I removed, much like the Golden Watch, once I removed my head from my own ass, I was able to appreciate what I liked and relieved the stress of trying to unpack and focus on all the elements I didn't like.
I had a good time. I'm sure I had a good time, just like people had a good time in the 90s when this just came out. Because it's a movie. Jeez. And I also just like to remind myself any second I can.
Literally no one knows who I am. And that brings me peace. So I hope that all makes sense. Like, I think it's really going to change all my movie watching experiences. And I hope I can take this little lesson with me onto the next 3 movies. Because it isn't just Pulp Fiction I've been yelled at for. I have a whole month of this category to get through. Yeah, I don't really 100% know what my problem is, but I just do know that I just need to be a little bit more relaxed, take a little bit more of the pressure off myself, and just watch the fucking movie. And sorry if this got like a little mushy, little gushy, like a soft, shapeless mass.
Kind of like a pulp.
Ta-da! I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed that. My first episode. Hi, hello, how are you? My name is Lucky Damn Day. It's really nice to meet you. And if you made it to this point of the podcast, we're kindred spirits. All right. And don't forget to tune in next week when I tackle another movie that makes people scream at me because I haven't seen it. What is that movie? Okay, fine, I'll tell you. Quit twisting my arm. It's Parasite. Woo-hoo! Holy shit, this movie. I tell ya, it awoken something in me. Tune in next week to figure out what the diagnosis is, okay? I'll see you then. Drink some fucking water.